This is Science Friday. I'm John Dankosky. About 90% of Americans over the age of 65 take one or more prescription medications, according to the CDC. About 40% take more than five prescription drugs. So imagine you've got blue pills for blood pressure, orange capsules for diabetes. You take the blue ones in the morning, the orange ones at night. But when you switch from brand name meds to generic ones, now your blood pressure pills are orange. Maybe your diabetes medication is blue. How do you keep track of what's what? In his new book, Generic, The Unbranding of Modern Medicine, Jeremy A. Green dives into the historical, political, and scientific underpinnings of this common dilemma, where you're left wondering if your generic and name brand medications are really exactly the same. And if they are, why do they look different? Green has previously been awarded the Rachel Carson Prize for his 2009 book, Prescribing by Numbers. He's also an associate professor of both medicine and the history of medicine at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, Maryland. Welcome to the program, Dr. Green.
Thanks so much, John. It's a pleasure to be here.
And if you want to join us with your questions about generic drugs, 844-724-8255. That's 844-SCI-TALK. So, first of all, explain what generic drugs are. Why were they created in the first place?
Well, you know, a kind of technical definition would be, in America, products approved by the Food and Drug Administration to be therapeutically equivalent with brand name versions. And that means they have the same active ingredients and the same dosage, purity, biological availability as the version originally approved by the FDA or the innovator drug. Now, you know, practically speaking, these drugs are the same in all ways that matter. We know, however, that they are never identical. And just for the reasons that you mentioned in the intro, they differ in size, shape, and color. They differ, hopefully, in price. They are intended to be cheaper. And that so much policy around generic drugs has to do with cost savings that we receive when we get equal quality products at a lower price. But we hope and we believe that these differences are trivial and the similarities are substantial. So generic drugs are a fascinating example of things that are the same but not the same. And the controversial emergence of them over the past 50 years is really the subject of this book.
And why are they so much cheaper?
Well, they're cheaper because so much of the price tag of a new drug is justified in the sense of the enormous research and development outlay that goes into producing it in the first place. A generic drug manufacturer doesn't have to demonstrate that a drug is efficacious, doesn't have to demonstrate that a drug is safe. These things have already been proven by the innovator manufacturer. All a generic drug manufacturer needs to prove is that the drug is the same. And so the hope is this opens up an arena of post-patent monopoly competition to many competing manufacturers that drives the price down.
Looking at generic drugs today, can we pretty much trust that they're regulated in a way that makes sense, that is giving us exactly the same drug in the generic form as we're getting with the brand name?
Well, yes. I mean, I want to reassure listeners that my book is not an expose of how generic drugs are dangerous or should not be trusted. As a physician, I prescribe generic drugs every week. As a patient, as a parent, I regularly either consume generic drugs myself or give them to my children. At the same time, it's very important to understand that the ways in which we demand proof of similarity have emerged historically. And all of the things that we ask, all the things the FDA asks to be proven to make sure a generic drug is therapeutically equivalent, we ask because of prior instances where the logics of similarity we were using were not sufficient, and things that we thought were similar actually had significant differences. So there's a historical emergence of this quality, and we're still left with the possibility, always, especially with new forms of generic drugs that continue to emerge, that there may be forms of difference that might be significant that we simply do not know of yet.
Well, you talked about the history. Why don't you give us some of that history about how generic drugs first came to be and maybe some of the early champions of generics?
Sure. So, you know, it really does. It's a fascinating story. And I think when you look at a thing like a generic drug, it seems so mundane, so trivial. As a historian of science, medicine, technology, there's a question, why write about something like a generic drug? But it's precisely because it is such a commonplace object in all of our lives that it's so interesting to notice that, you know, about 60 years ago, this object simply didn't exist at all. The generic drug industry is a very recent history and a very controversial history. You know, in 1960, less than 10% of all drugs are filled generically at the pharmacy. By 2014, more than 84% of all drugs are generic. And There's three things we could point at as different ways of understanding the emergence of generic drugs. One has to do with this boom of patent-protected innovative drug that really get launched into the American drug market in the wake of World War II. And so by the late 1960s, these post-war patented drugs, all their patents are beginning to expire, and there's a bolus of drugs that are going off patent. At the same time, the government is becoming increasingly involved in paying for medicines, especially through the passage of Medicare and Medicaid in the mid-1960s. So by the end of the 60s, there's an increasing political pressure in understanding why we pay so much for drugs when there may be chemically equivalent versions that could be cheaper. And the third thing I'd mention is this new value or this rise of thinking about the patient as a consumer and an increasing politics of consumerism that becomes increasingly important in healthcare in the late 20th century. And you see this reflected in a series of public, very, very public debates over whether generic drugs are the same as brand name drugs, whether there even is such a thing as a generic drug. Beginning with the congressional hearings of Tennessee Senator Estes Kefauver, really in 1960, carrying on through a series of different public fora where different stakeholders argue that generic drugs either are the same as brand name drugs, and therefore any attempt to say they're not the same is really a form of marketing smokescreen. Mm-hmm. And those, on the other hand, who say that protocols of similarity are really just ambitious, hopeful ideals that insurers or government regulators would like you to believe work but haven't been proven in actuality. And this debate really roils over the 60s, 70s, and 80s.
We're talking with Jeremy Green. He's author of Generic, The Unbranding of Modern Medicine. And we're taking some of your calls about generic drugs, and including this one from Brenda, who's in Toledo, Ohio. Hi, Brenda.
Hi. I actually have a comment on the difference between generic and name brand drugs. My brother is epileptic, and he has been on a cocktail of drugs for most of his life. He was on a name brand drug for epilepsy, which was working well to manage his symptoms. He switched over to the generic, and it was not effective. And they took a while to figure it out, but then he switched back once again to the name brand, and once again, it did the job. So he's had to actually advocate for himself with doctors who kind of don't believe that this is the case over the years. So,
well, Brenda, thank you for sharing that story, because Jeremy Green, it's one of the important stories about the differences that we do see between generics and the drugs that are first put out by manufacturers.
So, Brenda, thanks for your comment. And again, I'm very sorry to learn about your brother's difficulties managing his condition between brand and generic drugs. Epilepsy is an area of particular importance in understanding some of the problems in regulating generic similarity. There's been, as more and more states, for example, have passed substitution laws mandating substitution of generic drugs at the pharmacy in place of brand name versions, epilepsy is one of the areas in which we've seen a rollback. So not all states, but several states, particularly in the American Southwest, have begun to issue a carve-out to say that all drugs can be substituted except for epilepsy drugs, because these states do not believe that the conditions for exchangeability have been met. The FDA is incredibly interested in addressing this and has funded a number of studies to look at, well, how is it that these problems are happening? And one of the things to look at is the problem of an N of one. As you're saying, your brother has become his own advocate. And there's a big difference between, say, being on a generic blood pressure pill and having your blood pressure slightly vary one day to another, and being on a generic version of an anti-epileptic medicine, where the social, economic, personal, and vital consequences of a breakthrough seizure are so significant. Now, pharmacoepidemiologists have had long arguments over whether these kinds of events can truly be proof causally connected to the brand name versus the generic drug. The Epilepsy Foundation has been trying to advocate for increased standards of similarity, that some diseases like epilepsy, like the use of immunosuppressants after organ transplantation, antiretroviral cocktails for HIV, require higher standards of similarity than other drugs because the consequences of dissimilarity are so much more significant. But it's a very hard space to regulate, partly because convincing data on an epidemiologic, on a physical, chemical, bioavailable perspective has not yet been forthcoming to really show where these differences lie.
Well, this is one of the interesting things about this. Is, as we said in our introduction, there are some ways in which, legally speaking, generics are not supposed to be similar. For instance, if the pill that the major manufacturer puts out is blue, you're not supposed to make a generic drug that looks the same way. Why exactly is that? In a lot of ways, that doesn't make much sense.
No, it's a fascinating question, and one that I've really been engaging with over the course of research for this book. What you're talking about is really a question of how we decide what is patent protected in a pill and then becomes available to all manufacturers once the patent has expired, and what continues to be private property in the form of a trademark. And, the size, the shape, the color of a pill is seen to be immaterial to the functioning of that pill, and therefore not part of the patent, not part of its functionality, but part of the private property. It's called trade dress. And when a generic manufacturer makes a pill, if they were to make it look exactly the same, if someone who produced generic fluoxetine was to produce it in exactly an identical looking version to the green and yellow Eli Lilly Prozac, they could be sued for trademark infringement. And all of this is based on a supposition that the part of the drug that matters is only the active pharmaceutical ingredient.
And as a doctor, you know that's not true.
Well, no, it's not. And yet, these are the kinds of data that become hard to regulate in a way. So, for example, I've had patients, one particularly memorable case of a patient, a woman who had been very well controlled on her diabetes medication for years, and it switched from a yellow pill to a white pill. She didn't trust this white pill. She was confused by it. She went off of it. And by the time she came into my clinic, her fingerstick glucose was so high it couldn't even be measured. She was really steps away from diabetic coma and hospitalization. And her control had actually, which had been remarkable for many years, had really just been thrown by this change in appearance. And if you think about the fact that so many people are on, more than one medication, if you're on five medications and they're made by five manufacturers with five different looks, that's 5 factorial, or more than 3,000 possible different combinations of sizes, shapes, and color for you to remember to take at specific times. They could change every month at the pharmacy. It's almost like one value of the brand is a value of knowing the regular look and feel of the drug. And when you consume generics, they could change. The actual physicality of the drug can change every month.
We're going to just quickly say that I'm John Dankosky. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. And we're talking with Jeremy Green, author of Generic, The Unbranding of Modern Medicine. Let's go to Fernando, who's calling from Gainesville, Florida. Hi there.
Hi.
You're on the air. Go ahead.
So my question is actually about the equivalency standard that that you've mentioned. Is it based on chemical proof of it being the same molecule, like a mass spectroscopy reading, or something along those lines, or do they have to actually give the drug to patients and show similar effects as the brand name drugs?
So that's a fantastic question, and the truth is actually somewhere in between. So the current regulatory regime for a generic manufacturer to get a drug approved, something called an ANDA, or an abbreviated new drug application, and they have to prove that it has the same active pharmaceutical ingredient as the innovator drug, it's identical in strength, dosage form, route of administration, same indications for use, and it must be bioequivalent. And this is an important point. Bioequivalence is tested not through a clinical trial looking for efficacy, but it does require human subjects. And the standard form for orally absorbable medications is to take a pill, measure the absorption in the bloodstream at key measures along a time course, and make sure that that curve that you get is similar to the curve of absorption for the innovator product. And one of the fascinating aspects of bioequivalence that demonstrates this emergent, the historical quality of these sciences of similarity, that earlier standards of generic drugs didn't require bioequivalence. They required physical and chemical equivalence. And it was really when a blockbuster drug called chloromycetin went off patent in 1965, eagerly anticipated, lots of articles about it in Fortune, the Wall Street Journal, arguing that these generic versions were this patent cliff was anticipated. When generic versions hit the market, one of them was actually found to produce, when emptied into a glass of water, to produce a white scum that floated on the surface. And this led to some new investigations in volunteers being mostly prisoners at that time, which found that some of the generic versions, when swallowed, even though they contained exactly the right amount of chloramphenicol, would be swallowed and passed through the entire digestive tract unabsorbed. So you have this antibiotic that's used in a life and death situation. It's present in quality chemical form in exactly the right amount, but it doesn't make it into the body. And so before this discovery, the clinical importance of absorption was really somewhat negligible. After this, it becomes clear that actually this new regulatory regime is necessary. So what we do when we say these are the proofs that are required for generic similarity is we participate in something that is a form of cumulative knowledge that has come from realizing when unknown unknowns actually somehow become emergent and important.
I have to ask you about this case quickly. A man in Alabama wins damages from the pharmaceutical company Pfizer after suffering adverse effects from a generic medication that was supposed to be a copy of a Pfizer product. How could Pfizer be held responsible for a generic causing problems?
So this is a fascinating case, and at first it seems so counterintuitive as to almost be ridiculous when you put it that way. And yet this case really completes a fascinating triad of generic liability. All of these involve a drug called metoclopramide, or Reglan, originally marketed by Wyeth. And there's concerns that an adverse effect called tardive dyskinesia was improperly warned of in the label of the drug. There's a case in 2011 called Pleva versus Mensing.
I'll have to ask you to just quickly summarize, if you would, in a few seconds.
I'll be really brief, but essentially, a case in 2011 judged by the Supreme Court judged that generic companies could not be liable for adverse effects, that essentially generic companies don't make any claims about safety and efficacy, and so they can't be held liable for problems in these claims. All they need to do is show that drugs are the same, and since the drug was the same, they couldn't be held liable.
And we're going to have to leave it there. There's a lot more that you can find out. If you actually want to go to our website, sciencefriday.com/generic drugs, you can read an excerpt from the book, Generic, The Unbranding of Modern Medicine by Jeremy Green. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me, John.